I got sidetracked. I did what all my friends did. We studied science. So I ended up just studying neurobiology in school and then really loved that. And I went in this kind of total
hell
detour.
Of a sidetrack, man.
So, I loved it.
Hey, Mom, I'm gonna do a sidetrack that makes you much prouder.
What's going on, everybody? Welcome to another episode of American Desis. I am Arjun.
I'm Akash.
And today we have on here, you guys heard about this project in our interviews with Mega and Saurabh. I guess that was a month or so ago or a couple months ago, something like that. But today we have the pleasure of speaking with the creator of the super amazing Princess Heroes. You wrote the first book. This is Sanjay Nambiar.
Yes, thanks, guys.
And you wrote the first book and then... You wanted to tell us about, let's just start there, the first book. And it was called Super Duper Princess
Heroes. Yeah, when it first came out, the first book was called Super Duper Princess Heroes, and we recently changed the name to make it kind of the age range that it appeals to a little bit more broad, because we're building it out with a lot of different characters. So we're excited about calling it the Super Amazing Princess Heroes now. But the story and the platform is still the same.
And you wrote this book, how long ago was the first?
The first book came out in 2013.
Okay, and how long before that, when did the idea originate for you in your head or like?
It's interesting. So I've been a writer for a while. My background's a little bit different, but I have a series of books called A Little Zen for Little Ones. And those are three books in that series. They're all Zen stories for kids. So I've been writing children's books for a little while. And then, you know, I have two young daughters. They're 9 years old now. They're identical girls. They're crazy.
Oh, wow.
But I'm at the bookstore with them, you know, 5-6 years ago. And I remember it was a very specific moment. We're reading as a follow-up story to, I won't mention names, but she's the princess who loses her shoe. So she's sitting there, and in the follow-up story, she's with her prince. She's married. And the prince gives her a ring. It's like a giant rock. It's like this huge jewel. And she loses it, and she's completely despondent. She can't find it. So she enlists the two mice, Jacques and his friend, and they go scour the kingdom, and they can't find the ring. And the big, beautiful climax of this amazing story is that they fall into a well, and they find the ring, and they give it back to her, and she's happy again. Now, I wanted to burn the book in the store. So I'm still going, this is nonsense. We have so many amazing writers in L.A., let alone the country, and this is the garbage that we're putting out.
Right.
And I'm raising, you know, I want my girls to be independent and intelligent and educated and powerful and to be active and empowered. And well, all of their role models are passive.
Let's unpack. Okay, so that was the big thing, the passiveness. Yeah. And also was, I mean, what would bother me about that is just the material thing made them happy. Obviously, for someone that believes in or follows Zen, that's not a part of your lifestyle. So was that what you were like, then I got to write something new?
Exactly. That was the impetus behind it, right? If it's not there in the market, then we need to create it. And granted, that's starting to change. You know, like Frozen, they're more empowered. They're, you know, the lead in Star Wars is a woman now, Rey. So we have a heroine there. So I think around the market, you're starting to see books that are reflecting better role models for girls, especially in fiction for younger girls. But it's not completely blown out yet. I think it's going to get there. That whole girl power zeitgeist is growing. And for it's growing sure. globally. And it's a wonderful thing to see.
Now, the super. When did ethnic or different cultures become a part of the super, like when did that become a part of what you wanted to do with the Super Amazing Princess Heroes?
From the get-go. Okay. You know, my background's a little different. I grew up in Carson, so I grew up right next to Compton.
I grew up
super poor, single mom. So my experience growing up was super diverse. Like everyone around me was Filipino and Samoan, African-American, Latino. And that's what I knew in terms of culture and community. You know, after that, going to college and being in the workforce, you know, I saw that it was much more homogenous and didn't have that diversity.
Mm-hmm.
And again, you know, when I was looking at children's literature, when I was reading stuff for my kids, you have animals, which are, you know, are kind of diverse. But when you look at the characters, they all kind of look the same. And I noticed that when I was driving around town with my girls, I look at billboards, and the people on the billboards, the people in their books, don't look like my girls. My girls, you know, I'm dark-skinned Indian. They don't look like them.
Right.
And it's so important in literature for girls especially, but for everyone, to have role models that look like them. Because if you see it, you can be it. You know, it's a great line from the Genius Davis Institute. And so I really embraced that. So when I created the first story, the three main characters, and they're the three main characters throughout all the super amazing stories, their names are Kinney, Oceana, and Sammy. You know, one's blonde, one's half Asian and American, and one's half African American and American. And the idea is, like, I wanted them to look different. You know, I wanted them to have different skin tones and, like, to have different personalities and just reflect more diversity. And from there, you know, since we rebooted the brand last year, now we've got 15 Princess Heroes and they're very global. So we added 12 to the three, and there are Princess Heroes in Brazil, in Japan, China, Australia, Iran, India, Paris, Canada, all over the world, and they all have different shapes and sizes and different heights. They all look different, and I think that was so important for us.
Was there a conscious decision from you, or why the conscious decision not to have one of them South Asian, one of those first three?
It wasn't a conscious decision. It was more, well, a little bit, because you, sometimes when you write a story, right, or anything that's creative, it comes to me. And when it came to me, these were the first three characters that I saw.
Gotcha.
And also, it wasn't so much about my experience, but about creating a world and these princesses that I think would have a broader appeal. But also, it's still, at that point, that's the story that I saw.
Right.
So it wasn't necessarily like an intention, but it was more just part of that creative process.
There's a playwright, Tony, this is a bit of a tangent, Tony Kushner, who yeah. I love, who believes that all art is politic. Like all art must be political.
It's interesting.
I would love to hear, because I'm hearing that it comes from a political place, right? And a desire to change. Not political necessarily in like governmental politics, but like there's a politic, there's an agenda in the art of some kind. How do you respond to that?
I think it's a very powerful, very compelling comment. And it depends on the context. Yes, all art can be or is perhaps political, but is it political by intention, or is it political, is it de facto political by the manifestation of its output?
That's a really, right? I'm usually interested in it from an intention standpoint as an artist myself. Like that's where I kind of drop into that.
You know, so much of art is born out of personal experience. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the reason why so many artists are tortured. You have so much to express. Mm-hmm. And when you go through pain, you have more of that. You need to get out. You need to express that, whether it's music or painting or writing or whatever, or dance or whatever it might be. And if you're going to have that kind of pain, or you're going to have that experience that you need to express and you need to share with the world, that's going to be a little complex. And that's where you're going to see, you know, these artists that come from different types of family backgrounds, different types of communities. And I think inherent to that, there's going to be some political aspect to it, whether that's a downtrodden community, whether that's a personal experience. So because art is born of that type of experience, all of our experiences, whether we like it or not, are going to have some type of politic to it.
Right.
Just by being in a modern culture. I mean, even if you're in
But you're talking about unconscious politic coming out. But yours, whether, I don't know if you would agree with this, but there is a politics to Super Amazing Prince of Hero in that it wants to create space for all people. It wants to change what children's literature is for young girls. To me, that's there's politic to that. And it was conscious. But conscious doesn't necessarily mean bad. I'm just curious, would you agree that it's still conscious for you, or was that just how it started and now it's just about the story? I'm just curious.
Oh, absolutely. And sometimes, you know, it's a little bit of a semantics. And I agree. When I was creating it, and now as, you know, Sorab Kakani is my co-writer on this, and Mega Kadakia is my other co-founder, the three of us, as we're creating these stories, sometimes the intention isn't so much political as it is just about social awareness. And perhaps there's an inherent politics to that.
I would say that that's similar.
And then the idea there is that we're not pushing any specific agenda, mm-hmm. but it's more that we want to inspire kids around the world.
Right.
And there's so many ways. And the way we want to inspire them is showing them, look, you know, your role models can be cute and charming, have the gown, have the tiara. But once you put all that on, go be amazing. You know, right. Go kick some butt. Like, go save the prince. Don't fall asleep and wait to be, you know, and be kissed to wake up.
Right.
Don't go to a ball and lose your shoe, and that's how you find your worth.
Right.
You go out there, you have superpowers, you make a difference in the world. And sure, I think there's a political subtext to that. But sometimes if you're trying to change any type of paradigm, you're trying to change any status quo, you know, that is somewhat, it can be ennobled, but there's always going to be some kind of politics to it.
Right. I would love to take a step back to when you started with writing children's novels with these Zen books for kids, right?
Yeah.
What did you always write? Did you write other stuff besides children books? I'm curious as to why you started talking to children in this way, like why you wanted to express yourself through children's literature.
So my background's a little different, definitely not linear. I was always a writer growing up. That's what I was like really was strong at. And then when I went to college, I started off as an English major, and I was going to double in econ or whatever, and I thought I'd go to law school. I got sidetracked. I did what all my friends did. We studied science. So I ended up just studying neurobiology in school and then really loved that. And I went in this kind of total
hell of a sidetrack, man.
I loved it.
Hey, Mom, I'm gonna do a sidetrack that makes you much prouder. And then you call it typical.
Yeah, Dr. Sun, very good. Yeah. So yeah, I ended up going into business. I worked in investment banking. I got my MBA. And I did that whole thing. But I was always very dissatisfied with the corporate world. It just, you know, it could be lucrative, but that's never been my motivation. I didn't find a sense of purpose with it. I didn't find it fulfilling. But I always had this skill set where I knew I could write and I was a strong writer. So, you know, 10 years ago, I combined the two and started basically a copywriting business. So I wrote a lot of marketing copy and business copy for clients around the world, doing, you know, website stuff and writing speeches for clients as well. So I write speeches for executives and things like that. And then after I have my kids, you know, they're 9 now, that's the initial inspiration.
I got you. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
I thought, you know, okay. What? You know, I've always wanted to do this. Let me play with this a little bit and see if there's some ideas there. And, you know, spirituality is a big part of our family, a big part of what I, you know, embrace and espouse in life. And that was the genesis for the Zen series. Mm-hmm. And as we were mentioning earlier, just kind of seeing, you know, want better role models for my girls. That was the genesis of the Super Amazing Princess Heroes.
Can I ask you a question about something you mentioned really early on?
Yeah.
You grew up in a single family. You said
single
you
mother
up,
family.
Single parent family. You said you grew up poor. Can you give us more details on that? Are you comfortable doing that?
Oh, yeah, of course. Because I feel like our experiences are there to be shared. And I think the more we can be a little vulnerable or share that experience, you know, it benefits everyone.
Right.
So, I mean, 100%. My story, actually, it's a long story, probably too long for our session here. But so my mom was like really amazing. You know, she grew up in this super dirt poor village in Kerala in South India, like studied by kerosene, one dress the whole year long. But she was super smart. And she went to Bombay by herself, did nursing. Married, had my brother's 8.5 years older, and then she was the one who went to Scotland by herself and Boston by herself and brought over my brother and my dad. So it's kind of the reverse that you usually hear. She right. was yeah. the trailblazer.
As a nurse the whole time?
As a nurse.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, you see this in the Malayali community a little bit more. It's an interesting community.
A lot of nurses.
It's matriarchal. It's 100% literacy. That community's got some really interesting parts.
Really fascinating.
It's super leftist or all communist. Yeah, it's a trip. But she came to LA, and then, you know, my dad was an entrepreneur. He had these liquor stores. He was doing really well. And then, you know, right before my 5th birthday, one of the stores was robbed, and he was actually murdered. He was shot. So my mom was sitting there with a 5-year-old and a 13-year-old and completely on her own.
Oh my God.
You know, bless her soul, she actually passed away almost a year ago, exactly at the end of May last year.
Sorry to hear that.
Thanks. But it was, you know, so with that, you know, we went from, like, you know, on this verge of a lot of prosperity to having everything, you know, the rug ripped out from under us. And we were in Carson, and so we didn't have a lot of money. So I grew up with this sense of, like, it was very different, I feel. And I didn't realize this until I went to college, and I met, like, a lot of my good buddies are all Indian. We all grew up in the States. And I went to Cal, I was like, you know, my experience was really different. Because you don't know anything when you're growing up. When you're getting into early adulthood, it's like, most people didn't grow up with the lack of opportunity or lack of infrastructure that I grew up with. But more than anything else, it just motivated me even more.
Now, can I ask about the friend group that you had? One, when you were growing up, was the community around? Were there a lot of South Asians around you at the time? Or
not in our community.
Right.
Like, I grew up, I was like one of like 2 or 3 Indian people at our school, and all my friends were Asian. So, I mean, it was funny. I used to call myself Sanjay. And when I went to Berkeley freshman year, I introduced myself as Sanjay, and my buddies are like, you know your name's Sanjay, right? I was like, oh, I had no idea. Like, I didn't even know how to pronounce my own name.
Yeah. I would love to hear. So then you got to, it sounded like you went to UC Berkeley. So you went to UC Berkeley, and then you started meeting more South Asians, more Indians in particular. Was that, do you think that was just an organic thing? Was that a conscious thing for you? Did you start to say, hey, I'd love to get to know these people more? Because I grew up not having a lot of South Asians around me as well. And then I went to college, and I tried to create it. I was not successful creating that community, but I tried. Very consciously. So I was wondering, was the intention for you conscious or unconscious?
It was much more unconscious, but it was also, there was a lot of momentum for it. Because we started with a group of friends, and we were doing the Indian clubs at school and all that type of stuff. And we used to explore this, I think.
Were you drawn to the clubs for anything beyond grad school? Or was it just like, hey, this is an Indian club, I'm drawn to that?
Just for the fun. It was more social than anything else.
Right.
Just going, the parties were there. But the whole thing is interesting because, you know, we were all born in the States. We grew up in the States. My birthday's on July 4th. I'm as American as apple pie. But we all, you know, we had this similar skin tones, and we could make the same jokes and talk in the same funny Indian accent.
Right.
and we could relate to the same foods, even though, you know, my friends were like Gujarati and Punjabi, and I was, you know, Malayali, so even the foods were different and the language is different.
Right.
But there's something about that South Asian commonality that, you know, bonded all of us.
Right.
Even though if you look at it logically, there's beyond kind of just our parents' experience, we don't really have that, we're not immigrants, you know, first generation, we don't have that commonality within our experience, but there's something about that heritage, that legacy that glued us together in a way. And it's really interesting.
And so you found that became your crew.
Yeah.
And that's kind of continued through.
And that's continued throughout. Like I have friends, a lot of friends who are non-South Asian, but also I think that's the benefit of going to a UC and staying in California. Like my it's funny, we just went to the East Coast for my wife's 20th college reunion. And her friends are, you know, dispersed throughout the country. Because you go to East Coast College, and they're everywhere. They're in Texas, they're in Arizona, they're all throughout New England. You know, you go to UCLA, UC Berkeley, UC, most of the graduates are in the Bay Area or in LA.
Right.
So, like, my college roommates, all my close college buddies are all within, you know, 5 miles of me here.
Oh, wow.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
So, we're lucky that way, like, super lucky.
Yeah.
Do you think the root of your always wanting to write about strong women is your mom?
Absolutely. She's such an inspiration. My wife is a super strong woman as well. You know, she's like, she went to Brown and Harvard, she's super educated, she's a smart one in the family. And she's a great example for my kids. And she's always worked in education, and she's been a champion for people who had less privilege. And that's been a big part of her ethos and her, like, mission in life. And, you know, going back to, you know, the way I grew up in Carson and stuff, it just made me realize that it gave me so much motivation to give back. And that's so much of what I do. And, you know, hopefully I'll be able to do that and fulfill on that sense of purpose. But, and that's what I realized when I was in investment banking and other places, it wasn't fulfilling to me just to make a ton of money. Like, yeah, if that happens, that's great. But it's much more important to me, like, things happen for a reason. And people grow up in a certain way for a reason. And if I have these opportunities now to give back in whatever way it might be, and hopefully it's through these books to inspire these kids so that they can have better role models. And, you know, when they have playtime and they're 5, 6, 7, 8 years old, instead of having tea parties, they're out there being strong and saving people. You know, how does that impact the way they look at the world when they're young adults?
Right.
You know, if I can be a part of that, like, that's what I feel like I need to do with this life.
How did losing your father at 5 affect you in terms of not having a father?
It's really interesting because, you know, I had a really strong female role model, right, my mom growing up.
Which we see how that's impacted you.
Yeah, but not having a male role model, I'm a little more sensitive than most of my guys' friends.
Yeah, I'm noticing that.
It's a little foreign to me. And this has been my experience of parenthood too, is, you know, how to be a dad.
Mm. Right.
There's so much
you don't have the model. You don't have the model to it. Yeah.
There's so much to a great degree, unless we get into a lot of therapy at an early age, like we just copy what our parents do for better or worse.
Right.
Yeah. Because
that's what, you know, that's the context. That's the paradigm. And for me, like, I could copy what my mom did, or, like, kind of look at what other dads are doing, but I didn't know an example of, like, what it means to be a dad, because I never had one. It was one that I could remember. So, I mean, it's been a really interesting impact. You know, I think there are great benefits to that, because sometimes I don't fall into the standard, you know, machismo roles that we saw, especially with immigrant generation Indian dads. But, you know, there are also some downsides sometimes, kind of like just knowing what to do as a dad. Like, I have no idea.
So I'm going to tell you something. What I keep hearing from parents is that none of them have an idea.
No one knows. That's not true.
Let's talk about this expansion that happened. You wrote one book. You wrote, and it came out in 2013. It was at that moment Super Duper Princess Hero. And then what was your vision at that point? Did you just want to keep writing stories? When did, you know, Sorab and Mega come into play? I would love to hear that part of the story.
You know, I always saw it as more of a multimedia brand, as a platform, not just, you know, maybe one point of entry is the books, but to be with toys and merchandising and TV and animation. But there's no way I could do that by myself. And for years, I was looking for the right partner. And I've known Mega for 10 years. She's actually good friends with my wife. And we ran into her randomly at something in Malibu, some social thing. And I was telling her about what I was doing. And she was saying, oh, well, you know, let's talk about it. So I met with her later. And, you know, it's serendipity, because she was saying that's exactly what she was looking for in the next step in her career. She wanted something to empower girls. She wanted to do something with children's media. She wanted something that had more of a multimedia aspect to it, building a brand. And that's exactly what I wanted to do. So we partnered up with Sorb and her and myself. And we started pitching this to people, you know, about a year ago, 9 months or a year ago. And the feedback was tremendous. I mean, everything, from all aspects of media, from producers, people running brands, people in nonprofit space, the whole idea is like, wow, we don't have this. You know, this idea that you can be a princess and a superhero, this idea that you can be cute and glamorous and empowered and go out and save people.
Right.
And having this kind of subtext or this other foundation to it that's all about diversity. That's not just the US, not just looking a certain way, but it's global. Like putting all those things together, it's not really there in the market. So we feel like we're tapping into something. And that's when we start, okay, you know, we should run with this. And that's when we kind of just expanded that universe. We went from 4 characters to 32 characters.
Wow.
And this summer, we've got 2 games coming out, 2 additional stories, a trailer.
I can't wait to audition for this show, for the voice of some villain, because
we got some great boy characters. They're like super empowered and they're positive, but we got some villains too. Yeah, we got. We'd love to have you be a part of it.
That's fair. I wasn't actually. Now I feel super uncomfortable. Like, save me, please.
The reason he brought that up is because he's auditioned for Omega multiple times, and every time he's been soundly rejected.
Oh, that's true. I forgot about that until just now. That's
where it's coming from.
I wasn't even conscious, but that's true. I've auditioned for 2 of her projects that I didn't get.
Well, one of her projects, The Tiger Hunter, is directed by Lena Khan.
Yep, didn't get that one either.
She directed our trailer.
Oh, well,
really?
We were looking.
Say goodbye to that shot.
You'll notice.
At that point, it was 6-year-old girls who we cast on that one. So I'm like, you could have auditioned, but it might be a little awkward. I'm sorry.
No, nothing. I was cracking a joke. We're good.
Okay, but no, let's go. So you guys are at this point where you want to expand.
Yeah.
So you see this as like, you know, everywhere. I mean, like, this could be one. I mean, I see, like, from a business standpoint, I mean, this could go to every market because it's global.
Absolutely.
And then from a standpoint, and then, you know, with TV, with merchandise, with this is a really exciting sort of situation you find yourself in.
It is. I think the potential is enormous. Like, you know, we got our TV pilot. We're pitching that. We're developing toys and dolls. We got games coming. We have our next book comes out in the fall. There's a great story about that. It's a partnership with this nonprofit called World Children's Initiative.
Oh, yeah.
And they created a heart center. Actually, they're Indian guys. They're 2 Sri Lankan guys and an Indian guy. I went to college with my wife. They're amazing. After the tsunami in 2004, they built a hospital in Sri Lanka. They have funding from the Clinton Bush Foundation. They built a heart center in Uganda. It's the only one on the entire continent. They do the whole in the heart surgeries.
Oh, wow.
So they contacted me and they said, you know, we were trying to do something different in terms of fundraising. What do you think about a story?
Oh, cool.
So you know what? Actually, let's do more than that. Let's do an actual children's book. So we have a whole children's book that's about this heart center and our characters. And one of them gets sick. And there's a girl there who's Ugandan who becomes a princess hero. And they build a hospital.
Oh, wow.
It's really heartwarming. Got this amazing artist named Seti Pak in LA who painted everything. And she's not a children's illustrator. She's a fine artist. And she painted it on birch plywood panels. So the grain shows through all the painting. And just, it's beautiful. So that's coming out in the fall. And we really do see it as an international brand. Like the way you'd look at My Little Pony or, you know, DC or Marvel or Power Rangers. The same concept.
Right.
That's so cool.
But, you know, the other part of that we're really excited about with our international characters, because they're not just Western characters translated. Like we have an Indian princess and a Brazilian princess and, you know, an Iranian, Japanese and Chinese. You know, just imagine being in India and, you know, you don't have to look at Barbie and stuff, but you actually see Rina, our super amazing princess hero, who kind of looks like you. And she has a superpower of echolocation. She's got Dundia sticks and she's a superhero and she's a princess. And if you're a little girl in a village and you have that as a role model, like how inspiring is that?
Well, actually, I'm going back to this. If you see it, you can believe it or you can be it. Because I've been trying to codify for myself the power of reflection. You know what I mean? Because from an identity standpoint, I think that a large part of why, you know, I identify so strongly with the Black culture in the States is because when I grew up, they were the only ones that looked anything like me on TV. And so that was like, ooh, that's me. And and the power of that. So it's a wonderful way of phrasing it. I didn't really know where to go with that, except that was, I appreciate that because I do think it can have an immense impact and can really change things for a lot of people.
And then for boys, it's interesting. You have that from kind of a racial diversity perspective, but also in terms of empowerment from a gender perspective. Because you look at boys, their role models when they're growing up are Superman and Batman and Spider-Man. When they make believe, they're out there putting on hero costumes and they're usually, I mean, they're destroying everything in the house, but they're usually like saving people. The idea is like they're fighting bad guys.
Right.
Because they're just mimicking their role models. Girls, when they play make-believe, are typically trying to get married. Half the time, they put on a gown, and it's like a mock wedding, or they're having a tea party.
So interesting.
Right? So, like, and it's not because they're consciously choosing it. They're 5, 6, 7 years old, but that's what they're seeing in the literature and they read in the movies they watch, so they're just going to mimic that.
So they've already been
instead
programmed.
Of watching that, exactly, it's pre-programmed. But, like, instead of seeing, you know, putting on a gown and getting married, what if they see you put on a gown, a tiara, and you're out flying and putting out a fire? Or you're out saving the prince, then they'll do that when they make believe.
God, how lucky is your wife?
How lucky am I? She supports me in all this.
See well, what I was going to say, sensitive.
I was noticing that a lot of the people that you've worked with have been connections through your wife. So I would love to use that as a segue to talk about was when you were looking for your wife was and I don't know if she's Indian or not. I don't know.
She's
we know. Priya. We're looking at pictures. You know what I mean? We see.
She's Cindy.
Was that important to you?
No, not consciously.
Right.
I usually dated Indian women, but it's just like it wasn't like I actively sought that out. Mm-hmm. It just ended up being the people we were around. Mm-hmm. So there's always that context, so it was a little bit easier. And I think there's that cultural bond, that commonality we were talking about earlier. Mm-hmm. But I never really, my mom was pretty liberal about that type of stuff. I think as long as it was like a good girl and I was in love with her, she would have been fine with anybody. I was lucky that way.
Was she part of her
decision? She's super open-minded, and her parents are open-minded as well. So I think she would have married anyone as long as it was like the right fit. So to her, like having her husband being Indian wasn't a priority. Right. But at the same time, most of the guys she dated also were Indian. So it's kind of like it just happened by kind of inertia, maybe.
How are you passing your South Asian-ness on to your kids? Or is it important to you to do that? You feel the need?
It is. It's interesting because we don't speak the language. I can understand Malayalam, but I speak it. It's horrible. My accent's atrocious. Right. And, you know, Priya doesn't really speak Hindi or Sindhi. She can understand it, though. So we can't pass on the language. In terms of religion, you know, we don't ascribe to any specific religion. Spirituality is very important. Mm-hmm. And I think those types of mystic concepts we really try to espouse. We talk a lot about meditation. Mm. We don't talk specifically about Hinduism or Buddhism. Like, we'll touch on those things, but we're not teaching those to our kids.
Right.
We're teaching more of them about spirituality. I mean, so those are usually the two main, you know, vectors, if you will, for passing on heritage.
Right.
We have our food and we have our dress. They love dressing up. So they're very aware that they're Indian and they kind of know what being Indian means.
Right.
But it's also interesting, too, because I think Indian for our generation is different for our parents.
Yeah.
Like, for our parents, they weren't necessarily Indian. They were Malayali. They were Sindhi. They were Gujarati. They were Punjabi.
Yeah.
Because that's where they came from, and that's the language and the culture and the food. Our kids aren't going to necessarily, you know, identify being Sindhi or Malayali. They're going to identify just being, you know, pan-Indian.
Right. Pan-Indian.
Huh.
I haven't heard that term yet.
So is it important to...
I was going to say, I was like, that's a new name for the podcast, guys. we're going to rebrand every year from now on. That's smart.
Is it important to take trips back to India? Is there like conscious stuff beyond food and dress? Or is it like...
It's
going to be different, so let's see what it turns into.
Oh, I'd love to do that. I mean, last time I went back was in 2005. Okay. And I haven't been back in a while. And it's hard to travel with kids, it's expensive and all that type of stuff.
Right.
But I really want to take them back for a couple of reasons. One, you know, to show them the heritage and the legacy and the history and the culture. Right. But also India, especially in the big cities, is such an interesting place because you have this juxtaposition. I mean, you see it in LA, but there I think it's more severe, of extreme wealth and extreme poverty. And I want to expose them to that because they can see, you know, people in other parts of the world live very differently.
Here's the biggest gift that I always said about traveling to India and what India is to me. It's everything at life at you. You know, right? Every city, every space that you go in has every aspect of life. But we in the West, and for whatever reason, I'm not interested in why at this moment, but we separate things and we separate, you know, the hood from...
We insulate ourselves.
We just separate. All of those things are separate and colors are in different places. In India, you don't have a choice. So you have to experience the full richness that is life. And you know, that can be a really expansive opportunity. For some people, it's a really intense and very hard opportunity or a hard experience. But for me, I think of it as just an enormous gift.
Yeah, man, we could talk about this forever. But that's such an interesting concept, right? Because a lot of people grow up in India and you go, you know, because there's so many people. But you grow up in an apartment building where you have everyone's in your business.
Mm-hmm.
Like you got 3-4 generations, all your aunties and cousins and uncles. But then, you know, everyone's there to help and support each other. You know, it takes village. And I think there are beautiful benefits to that, but also there's some costs. I mean, that could be a headache.
Sure.
Here, it's the exact opposite.
Yeah.
I mean, you got people living, you know, in these huge estates. They're a half mile close to the next living person.
Right.
And it's very isolating. It can be very lonely, but they have a lot of privacy and they have their own space.
Right.
So it's like, it's a very different way of living. Yeah.
Right. And I think at the end of the day, it's always going to be about personal preference and always about balance. You know what I mean? I think that, you know, I went down to Cuba and I was sitting there. I was like, God, man, everyone, you guys get it. And I wish that I could take the lessons that you have here and bring them back to the States. And then I'm talking to everyone, and about 90% of the people I was talking to couldn't wait to get to Miami. Yeah. So, you know, there's a grass is greener as well to the situation. But travel, that was my plug for travel, guys. That was my that was my soapbox moment for traveling to India. That I should be on the tourism board.
Get it.
Incredible India. Man, screw that shit. Expensive India. See what I'm doing?
I like that. I like it.
Expensive pan India. We don't have a ton of time with you left. So I want to ask you, you know, where can people, is Super Amazing Princess Heroes, are there more books out? You said that one's coming out in fall?
The next one? So that'll come out in the fall. The first book's available in bookstores everywhere. You can get any library, any bookstore, Barnes & Noble, Amazon. That's out everywhere.
Awesome.
If the bookstore doesn't have it, just ask them. They can order it.
Right.
And we have a couple games coming out. And even those are takes on traditional games, but they're made a little more empowered.
Oh, cool. Let's
see. Our first game's a dress-up game. And you have a bunch of dress-up games for this age range in the market. You get a princess or a mermaid or whoever it might be, a bride, and you just dress them up. You just put them, change the color of the hair and put on their shoes and the gown. And kids and girls love these games. But usually that typical game, you do that and you're done, right? And you take a snapshot. With our game, it starts off, you choose a superpower. Someone needs help. You know, you can fly. You can change the weather. You're really strong, really fast. You can breathe underwater. And then you go dress up your character. You put on the gown and everything. And after the character's dressed up, the character you created, you watch her go on a little adventure. And she saves a dolphin. Or she makes it grow in a farm that's dry because she can control the weather.
Right.
Wow. So here it's hitting on that same concept. Have fun. Dress up your character. But what does the character do after she's dressed up? She does something amazing.
Right.
So that game's coming out in the next 2 to 4 weeks. We have another game.
I have 2.5-year-old nieces who, are they too young yet for these?
Or? No, absolutely.
Ready for this game. I can't wait for them to.
Yeah, it depends where they are, you know, how they play with iPads and stuff. But the princess, you know, market goes from anywhere from 0 to 10, depending on what type of content. It's really 3 to 8.
Okay.
But it's interesting, you know, my co-founder Sorb has a great story. He was at LMU here talking about another film he was working on, and they asked him, what are your other projects you're working on? And he just mentioned in passing that he's working on, you know, Super Amazing Princess Heroes, and here's what, you know, what it's about. Just a couple sentences. In the audience, spontaneous applause from everyone, from the 100 people there, the women and the men. And that doesn't happen a lot.
No.
And a lot of millennials are saying, I wish I had this when I was growing up.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so we're finding this may have, like, really great broad appeal because of those reasons.
Yeah. Is there a website? There's a web they showed us. Is that live yet, or is it?
Yeah, everything's live. You can see all the characters and read about them. We even have it's at superprincessheroes.com.
Superprincessheroes.com.
And there we also have a whole segment. There are resources for parents, articles on bullying, things like that.
Awesome.
We have this great page called Real Life Princess Heroes.
Oh, awesome.
So we profile real women throughout history who've had an impact.
That's so dope.
Right? Because the idea is, like, you have these fictional characters. Oh, hey, they have superpowers, but you know what? You know, let's learn about Maya Angelou. Let's learn about Marie Curie. Let's learn about Amelia Earhart, Eleanor Roosevelt. These people, women who maybe didn't get the notoriety that men would have received, but had a huge impact. Right. So we profile them. That website's out. All of our social media handles are Princess Heroes.
Amelia Earhart's going to have an interesting ending.
Yeah, we'll see where that one goes. No one really knows yet, though. We're still looking. It's a to be continued.
She went on a journey.
This is so exciting. You create an amazing ecosystem, or whole multimedia platform. I mean, and it's really, I'm excited for it. I'm really truly can't wait to put this front of my nieces. They're gonna have a blast with it.
Well, I'll definitely give you guys books before you go. But my whole thing is, like, sure, you know, we're trying our best. You know, it's hard. It's not easy to launch a brand and a multimedia company. So we are working day and night, but, you know, hopefully we can make an impact.
Oh, I know we went through the whole thing, but I did think of one last question that if you have time.
Of course.
You know, I talked with Megha about this, about funding, and I have a big thing with, like, you know, the South Asian community. If we want to, you know, let's put our money where our mouth is, you know what I mean? And let's like you said, if it's not in the market, let's create it. We have more agency and more power, and this is something Akash always talks about. Let's do it. Let's make it ourselves.
Absolutely.
When you've been looking for financing and funding, has the South Asian community stepped up, or has that been more difficult?
We're looking for our first round of financing this fall.
Oh, okay.
So we're bootstrapping everything right now.
Pause that question until 6 months. That,
yes, we'll do, we're going to have a follow-up interview come, like, November, December, and I'll have more input on that one. But I think, you know, because Meg and Sorb have raised money for their films from the South Asian community.
Right.
So they've had success there.
Right.
So we're confident we can go back and then get that support. And we hope that happens.
I hope so, too. I really, I keep advocating, you know, we're one, we're fortunate or blessed or lucky, whatever we want to, whatever word we want to use, to be a generation and a community that largely has a fair amount of financial wealth. And I think that that gives us, I think that that gives us a responsibility to what we want to do with it. And I think that this is the kind of stuff I'm interested in being a part of. And so this is really exciting.
Yeah, we got to champion each other. We got to be our own advocates. And we got to, if we get that support from the community and if those people who have that kind of, those resources can embrace these types of projects, it's going to benefit everybody.
Now, obviously,
no, Origin makes a lot of money. So
I'm about to talk to you guys about that first round of financing, you know, but not on air.
We gotta cast some stuff soon too.
But
so let's see.
No, real talk. I mean, and the blessing is obviously this is a global thing. This is not just, you know, a South Asian thing. I mean, so you can hopefully financing can come from everywhere. I'm really excited. Best of luck as it continues.
Thank you.
We'll be looking out for Princess Heroes on social media. We'll be looking out for superprincessheroes.com. And the books, go to. Do you guys know what a library is? A library is a place where books exist. Go there, find out.
Maybe they have it on microfiche, since we're talking about antiquated things.
Just check your index card, Dewey Decimal System.
There you go. Guys, this is where we do our little spiel, so I will say that we're going to have a dope Facebook post about this, obviously. So when you guys are liking this, which I really appreciate how many likes we're getting, just like an inch or two away from that is this little button that says share. If you could press that or click that for us, that would be wildly helpful as we keep building our community and hopefully can create more champions for each other and bring amazing stories to y'all. And now Akash,
I'm sick
yell
of
at
y'all.
People.
I'm so sick of y'all. I'm so sick of telling you to review and rate and subscribe to the podcast. You don't do it. You are constant disappointments. I feel about you the way my family feels about me not being a doctor. That's the level of disappointment I have in you as a listenership. I'm done.
All right.
Done asking.
Next week, we will be dropping more amazing content, so, you know, be on the lookout. I'm Arjun.
I'm Akash.
I will catch you next week.
God bless.